ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. Have you ever opted out of a social plan because it's just felt too hard to show up, or felt tense and terrified at the thought of speaking in public or any other face-to-face interaction? Today, let's talk about social anxiety, which research tells us is on the rise. Do you think you've become less social and possibly more socially anxious than you used to be? And how's that affecting you? Then, in 40 minutes' time, the aunties deliberate on competing needs for sleep and cutting loose. Let's talk. We humans are social creatures, but that doesn't mean getting out there and mixing and mingling comes naturally to a lot of us. And I want to be clear, social anxiety isn't about making the conscious choice to stay home because you need downtime. It's about making that choice because of the fear, anxiety, and stress of going out and interacting with other people. Rates of social anxiety are reported to be highest among young people, with social media and devices often seen as factors. But do personality types also influence how social anxiety affects us? Let's find out. I'm joined by Sara O'Doherty, a psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Sara, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Bev. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the show. Now, tell me about the research on social anxiety. Are we becoming less social, more anxious? What does the data tell us?
There is lots of international data around this, and in similar kinds of countries, so in the UK, in the US, the data shows that there is quite an explosion of social anxiety. When we talk about Australian data, it's actually a little bit lower, but there's always going to be, difficulties, I guess, with collecting that sort of data and who we're collecting that data from. But what we know is that it is still quite a prevalent condition and a lot of people experience it. I see it quite often, again, particularly in those younger generations in my clinic. So it's definitely an issue.
So what's going on there with younger people and social anxiety?
There's a few different, I guess, contributing factors to this. So for instance, there is more of that, I guess, social influence to be on devices, to maintain connections with people virtually. So we're seeing people in person potentially less than we might have been in older generations. And because of that, it means that a lot of young people are actually out of practice when they are needing to establish or maintain friendships, but also when they are needing to go out and explore or do tasks that mean they are interacting with people who might be outside of their comfort zone. There is not as much opportunity that they might be taking or opportunity that they are creating for themselves to actually go out and extend or expand their comfort zones in talking to new and different people.
I mean, I think for myself that even though I come from a generation where I think we have the experience of opening up a phone book and just cold calling, so I think there is that muscle that was involved. But I think about how I socialize now, and I do see people less frequently, but I text with them a lot more.
Yes. And I think that texting has just become, you know, that low pressure, low key kind of alternative. Because picking up the phone and committing to, you know, sitting on a phone, talking to a person seems so much more challenging and effortful, whereas texting seems so much easier. And I think a lot of the time we do tend to go for that easier option.
So can you talk about the difference between social anxiety disorder and possibly just being shy?
For sure. So essentially, these sorts of anxieties exist on a spectrum. So some people might experience it very, very low levels, maybe only in particular circumstances. But when we're talking about a disorder, we're looking at functional impairment. So this is a condition where they're experiencing anxiety symptoms. So those really classic fight or flight symptoms, racing heart, difficulty breathing, shaking, sweating, all of those very unpleasant experiences. And they're occurring in multiple different contexts with multiple different people, different times of the day. It's not limited to just one thing. Mm. And when we're talking about functional impairment, what that means is it's actually getting in the way of people doing what they want to be doing and doing what they need to be doing in order to have the kind of life that they want to be having.
Right. So that's a difference between, say, what I joked about with Sally a few minutes ago, which is like, yes, the relief, you know, we see social media memes about this, you know, the relief of when your plans fall through and, you know, people are dancing and like, oh no, how terrible, but they're actually thrilled. I mean, there's that side of it and I think we can all relate to it, but how do you know when it's actually doing what you just said, which is getting in the way of the life that you want to live?
So a lot of it comes down to how much time we are sitting there thinking about it. So we might be churning over or ruminating over particular kinds of thoughts, and that can actually take up quite a lot of our time and our brain space and our energy. And then it actually impedes our motivation and our drive to go out and do the things that maybe we need to do. So everyday sorts of tasks become super overwhelming. Going grocery shopping or seeing friends, we become really avoidant and really withdrawn. And the longer term impacts could be that it really negatively impacts on our friendships or our ability to work, those sorts of things.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Beverly Wang, speaking to Sara O'Doherty, a psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Sara and I are talking about social anxiety, which is the fear or the stress of going out to do, like what Sara said, grocery shopping, going out to meet people, going to a party, dining alone, ordering in a restaurant. Now, Sara, it's interesting talking about social anxiety. I reflect on myself and I think I feel very comfortable right now doing what I'm doing, which is talking into a microphone, live radio, you know, people listening, and that's fine. But if you ask me to go to a networking event or a party, if you invite me out of the goodness of your heart to do that and I am solo there, I am actually terrified.
Yes.
I do not know how to cope. I feel very uncomfortable when I go in. My mind is racing and I feel very, very nervous and self-conscious. So I just think, like, it's not consistent, our social anxiety, is it?
No. And what you've just described there, I think, is this universally terrifying situation. And there are very, obviously, there are going to be exceptions to that rule. Some people are going to feel energized when they go to those sorts of events. But what you're describing there, I think, comes back to one of the key aspects of social anxiety, which is fear of judgment. We are afraid of going into an environment where we may or may not know the individuals around us, and we're terrified of doing something that could embarrass us or make us look silly in front of people, and then feel really judged by those people. And a lot of the time that can be small things that we're worried about. We're worried about, you know, tripping over in public, for instance. But in those sorts of networking events, it can be, you know, I'm going to make a fool of myself because I don't know what I'm need to say, or I mess up with, you know, trying to make a connection with someone at this networking event. So that fear of judgment is absolutely something that is universal and actually is even more so pronounced in young people.
Yeah. So I can relate to when I think about how I feel going into an event like that, I can definitely relate to young people feeling fear of doing something that's equivalent to them. Here's a question from the text line. Sara, and I'd love to know what you think. Tina says, years ago, I'd get my children to answer the phone, which was attached to the wall. It taught them basic social skills. Not sure what the modern equivalent is. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if there is a modern equivalent.
Oh, she says maybe using the checkout at the supermarket. But then I think there's a lot of automated checkouts these days.
There really are. Like we're taking the people, the social contact, all of those little micro social contacts that we have are now just being eliminated really from society. So, you know, I very much remember, you know, sitting at the kitchen table with holding the phone, talking on the phone with the phone that was attached to the wall with the curly cord. And that was really good practice. Mm. Things like making doctor's appointments, you know, you can do that online now. You don't have to ring the GP practice. You can avoid a lot of that person-to-person verbal communication. And what we're actually doing here is we are degrading our skill sets because this is a skill that people do need to learn in order to effectively navigate through life.
Here's a text from Sam in New South Wales. Sam says, I would call in, but because of social anxiety and personality type and trauma, I can't. My whole life has been about wanting to be invisible, which after doing a lot of therapy, I now see is due to trauma and internalized shame. It wasn't labeled as social anxiety till my 30s. I've worked through it by crafting a world of solitude, which works for me, but I work through it in my social anxiety group therapy. Any thoughts on what Sam has shared, Sarah?
Absolutely. You know, what they're sort of referring to here is our fight or flight mechanisms. And one of the other mechanisms here is also the freeze response. So we shut down and then we might flee. We might go into that flight mode where we are withdrawing or isolating or running away. And over a lengthy period of time, what this can look like is avoidance. And when we get into that avoidance cycle, it becomes even more difficult for us to reemerge from our very safe, very cozy little burrow to then be able to go out and meet people and interact with people. So group therapy for social anxiety is absolutely perfect because you're there in a room with lots of other people who might be experiencing something similar to you, and it's a safe, contained environment where you can learn the skills that you need to be able to emerge from your burrow.
Emerging from the burrow. Is that part of it, that the burrow is so very, very cozy too?
Completely. And if we have sort of made this burrow really comfortable, really familiar, why would we want to leave it? So it becomes even more challenging to leave it because not only is it safer, it's preferred.
Yes. Let's welcome Penny in New South Wales to Life Matters Now. Penny, thank you for your time. And I understand you've always had social anxiety. How does that show up for you?
I don't know if it's a part of my personality type, but I am a bit on the introverted side. So anytime there's a social interaction, it takes an awful lot of energy. And I'm always fearful to start with. It was through my business life when I'd have business meetings or I had to give a talk. If I had to go to a family function, I'd often disappear into a room on my own or pretend to have a sleep because I was tired just so I could get away from everybody. But now that I've retired, it's a real struggle for me to force myself, if you like, to get up and go to activities. There's a wonderful women's group all around town that I'm involved with. But even just going out to lunch, you've got to gird your loins, so to speak, in order to be able to go to these functions.
Yeah, Penny, it sounds really tough. I wonder what makes you, I guess, like you say, force yourself, gird your loins to do that. Is it because you know that it's important?
Well, I read an article about longevity and all the things that you need to do to, you know, have a good long life. And the number one thing was social interaction. Mm. And it's about the number one thing that I struggle with the most.
Yeah.
So it's just every day I lie in bed saying, will I go, won't I go?
Yeah.
Will I go, won't I go? It's always something that I struggle with.
And tell me about actually being in the social interaction or the afterwards, do you feel like you've been energized or do you feel like you've been depleted?
Oh, no, I'm absolutely depleted. I'm like a wet rag. If I've had to give a talk at work or something, I'll get home that night and I'll just be sort of gaga on a chair.
Yeah.
I'd have to go to bed early. It just takes all my energy. It strips every single part of me, my brain, my limbs, everything. It's really quite physical.
Yeah, that sounds really rough. Sarah, I'd love to know your thoughts because Penny, you know, she points out that she obviously understands the need for social interaction, but if it's making her feel so depleted, I mean, is it worth it?
It's 100% worth it, I think. So
even though she says she feels, Penny, you feel depleted and like you're a wet rag.
Yes, it's not every single time, yeah. But certainly at a big thing where I've had to, like if I have to go to a party with a lot of people, I'm on my own, so I am turning up on my own. And that first step of saying hello or desperately looking for somebody that I know that I don't feel too tense with, you know, it just does. It takes its toll. I reckon it adds a whole level of stress to the body that can affect you physically.
Yeah. Sorry, to come back to you, Sarah.
Absolutely. It is very classically introversion here. And when we're talking about that sense of energy, you know, when we are expending so much energy, particularly when we're not naturally inclined to that particular kind of preference, it absolutely will take your toll. But when we're talking about that in combination with the social anxiety, so what this person is talking about is the rumination, that thought process, that questioning, do I go, do I not go, that mental energy also takes the toll. And so when we have both of those, factors working in combination, so the introversion and the social anxiety, it is going to be completely demotivating to go. So the fact that you are going is fabulous because sometimes we have to do things that are good for us that aren't necessarily pleasant in the short term. But what they are contributing to is our long-term well-being and in this case also the longevity.
So Penny, do you think it's worth it? Obviously you make the effort.
Well, I do enjoy it, and I like the socialness about it. And when I become more relaxed with people and I get to know them, it's not the strain. It's just that really that first step, that initially getting out there and trying. I do wonder if it's added a level of stress to my body, though.
Yeah. What do you do to de-stress?
Go for a walk.
Yeah.
I read. I read a lot. Mm. Watch TV. I could quite happily sit at home and not speak to another person for the rest of my life. I'm comfortable at home. I've got three children, you know, I'll send them notes. But it's something that I know I have to do because it's important.
Well,
it's important for my mental health and my physical health.
I'm glad you've put yourself out there to take the time to talk to us this morning, Penny. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
Have a good morning. Bye. Let's move on to Rick in Queensland. Rick, you have what you describe as periodic social anxiety. What do you mean by that?
Well, after hearing initially the talk this morning on your radio show, I don't believe necessarily that I have what would be considered a disorder. However, when I first read about social anxiety, I more or less diagnosed myself believing that I, you know, had the disorder of social anxiety. However, for me, it's more periodic than it is regular. And I guess, too, one of the things I thought about is I gave up drinking alcohol over 30 years ago. And normally in social situations, one of the first things I would do is have a drink or two. And I see now how that kind of took the edge off potential anxiety that may have been there, but because of the alcohol, kind of lubricated, you know, my anxiety. So I often wonder, well, I believe genuinely that there was a connection there with me not realizing until, you know, I had given up drinking. I have done a lot of acting in my life professionally and also in the local community theatre, and you know, I don't have a problem performing on stage. However, I recognize one evening at a cast party gathering, actually it was when I went to see a play and we were in the foyer at interval and I just started sweating profusely and I needed to go outside and breathe in some fresh air because I was feeling really anxious. And So that has happened not often, but every now and then I've experienced that. But generally speaking, socially, I'm fine. However, I do also not really socialise as much as I once did. I'm, you know, in my 60s now. And so I really relate to this. And I think it's such a great topic. Mm. And I'm looking forward to other people sharing their experience.
Really appreciate you sharing, Rick. You've given us lots to think about, in particular, that connection between coping with with the social anxiety by turning to alcohol, Sara.
Yes. Yeah. And what we know is that alcohol is absolutely used as a social lubricant. But what alcohol does is it lowers our inhibitions. So things that would be difficult or challenging or that we might have previously perceived as risky or threatening are much easier to do when you're intoxicated. Sometimes that feels in the moment like it is a positive thing. So for instance, socially, but often what this means is we become reliant on it, particularly because substances like alcohol obviously are addictive.
Yes. Well, let's take another call from Lisa in Narm, Melbourne. And Lisa, you're on the line because, for full transparency, you texted to say how frustrated you are to have to text to communicate. So we have decided to give you a call and you said yes. Thank you very much for that. How is this topic landing for you?
Hi, Beverly and Sara. It's landing pretty raw. not so much because I'm feeling the kind of social anxiety that's been discussed so far, but so much kind of on the other side where I feel like life's just become really inefficient, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. This is not to be insensitive to the people experiencing those symptoms, but I guess growing up as a digital native, I've kind of gone through the rounds of adopting all the apps, loving texting, but now it feels like all my friends who are in a similar demographic just prefer the text. And all I ever do is triage a slew of notifications on my phone.
Yep.
Apologies, I'm babysitting. Oh. Just triage a slew of notifications on my phone from all the different platforms, DMs and whatnot. And I'd rather just pick up the phone, frankly.
It is kind of exhausting, isn't it? I mean, not to name names, but I'm in group chats, which I love. But, you know, we resort to setting up polls to see when we can get together. And then, you know, if the votes don't line up, then where does that leave us? It can seem efficient, but actually I can completely relate to your situation, Lisa. Do you ever just pick up the phone and call these friends who prefer to text? And how does that go over?
It's more common than not that the phone call doesn't get picked up. Yep. It goes to voicemail or they decline. And I just follow up with urgent or non-urgent, you know, this is the context. Just want to say hi or just to get back to you on something.
Yeah.
It seems a bit more and more futile as time goes on to try and make that phone call.
Sara, what do you think of what Lisa's sharing here?
I feel like this is a super common problem. And it's not just the inefficiency of texting, which I 100% agree with. It's also that one of the really common issues that I see in my clinic is people getting into relationship conflicts over text.
Mm.
This is the absolute worst thing that anybody can ever do, is have a back and forth relationship conflict via text.
Oh, it's
because
terrible.
What is going to resolve it is actually having a verbal conversation over the phone, or even better, a face-to-face conversation. And the whole thing is going to end up being so much smaller than what we had initially built it up to be in text.
Mm.
So yes, hugely inefficient. Let's get back into the habit of talking to each other.
Lisa, I don't know if I have a solution for you, but I do appreciate you shining light on the situation that many, many people can relate to. So thank you so much and have a good day. And thank you for talking to us on the phone. Appreciate it.
No worries.
This is Life Matters. I'm with Sara O'Doherty, psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Now, Sara, let's talk personality types.
Yes.
Because I think our callers have shown us that there are different personality types that respond differently to social engagement. And we've all heard of extrovert and introvert.
Yes.
But I now know that there are other terms. Ambivert.
There are other verts.
The universe of verts. Ambivert, omnivert, introvert. Can we go through this technology terminology, please? And let's just do extrovert and introvert just to really, you know, have the primer. So an extrovert, how would you define that?
Okay. So before we start defining this, let's just sort of set this up by saying when we talk about this kind of personality trait, it was initially defined as very, very distinct categories. Now, what we know is they're not distinct. People can exist on a spectrum between introversion and extroversion, and we can switch, we can change, we can grow, we can adapt. So that is really, really important. So when we talk about extroversion, it is people who gain energy from being around other people. They love social dynamics. They love getting involved in social situations. They'll often be very talkative. They might come across as being quite confident. Where the flip side of introverts is people who much, much prefer being by themselves. They find social activity to be quite draining, like that previous caller. And what they might do to recover from that is really have that quiet alone time in order to recharge.
And what is an ambivert then?
Goodness. Okay. So an ambivert is someone who might sit maybe in the middle of that spectrum. So they prefer much more balanced approaches to socializing. So they're not one or the other.
Okay. And an omnivert?
An omnivert is someone who swings quite dramatically between extroversion and introversion. Now, I haven't met too many of these people, but apparently this is a thing.
Because it exists on a continuum, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's, again, it's what all of these labels really say to me is people like to have a label to feel like they can define themselves so that they can have a little bit more of that social awareness. And also just to see, you know, where they might fit amongst their peers. Mm. So introversion, for instance, is a relatively new term. And it's people who feel like they don't fit or can't fit with the dominant social, expectations. And so they end up being on the periphery of those social engagements.
Okay, so I hear you. And I'm just going to say that I'm kind of a personality type skeptic, I think,
yeah,
because so much of it is based on testing. And the testing is quite loaded, I think.
Like, and also, it's been clinically disproven.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of, like, for instance, this all came about because of the Myers-Briggs or the MBTI. And, you know, it's not a really reliable or valid testing measure. It's fun to do.
Yes.
But it is not necessarily clinically relevant. It might be relevant in things like corporate spaces.
Yeah.
So a lot of corporate spaces still use these kinds of personality tests, but they're not super clinically relevant.
So how much should we hang our hats on this then in connection to social anxiety or even using them as labels?
So definitely not in terms of social anxiety, but definitely in terms of if you feel like it is, if it feels true for you. So if you resonate with a particular kind of label and it makes sense to you and you're comfortable using that label, there's no harm or foul in, you know, going and labeling yourself, you know, doing the MBTI, the Myers-Briggs, and being able to say, you know, I'm more extroverted than I am introverted, for instance. Mm. But how it plays out in real life is a lot like the callers. You know, some people are going to be super introverts with social anxiety who still manage to go to social events and appear a little bit more confident or extroverted than they are. Or it might be feeling super confident in some areas and then getting panic attacks and high levels of anxiety in other areas of their life. So it's really different on a case-by-case basis.
Let's go to Ray in the ACT. Welcome to Life Matters, Ray. You need to email constantly for work, but you found something that works a lot better as a way to connect. I'd love to hear about it.
Well, essentially, I've found that actually having phone conversations with, well, which I'm going to call them clients, although that's not a paid thing, as I'm a conservation advocate. And emails are very good because you've got a very structured kind of answer. You can, it's concrete and it's solid. It's a business model. But I find that I really get good results if I phone people and we have unexpected kind of conversations where things come up unexpectedly because we've got a dialogue going.
So how does this relate to social anxiety, Ray?
Pardon me?
How does this relate to social anxiety?
It doesn't. It just has to do with, I think, the anxiety that we maybe feel as a society is because we don't actually... We don't actually have permission to phone each other anymore because
it's
more natural thing to do is to actually text or email.
Yeah, interesting. It isn't interesting, Sarah. I find myself compelled sometimes to text someone and say, "Hey, can I call you?"
Yes, because texting feels like, I guess, an easy way in. And we feel like a phone call is far more intrusive. So for instance, you know, during work hours, for instance, we might not be able or willing to take the call. And I think that we are really conscious of the fact that, you know, when we're at home or when we're doing something else, we might not want to be disturbed. And so we project that onto other people and we think that they don't want to be disturbed. So asking via text and checking for that permission first seems to be a little bit more usual these days.
Yeah, and I guess it's a bit of an acknowledgement that maybe a call is not welcome. Interesting text here from an 18-year-old texter and listener. Thanks, Ben, for listening. Ben says, "I'm very much part of the anxious Gen Z generation. And I think that a big misapprehension about us is that our anxiety comes out of naivete or stupidity. I suffer from a mild to moderate social anxiety. And one way it manifests is that I have to hype myself up to speak to people. The reason I do this is because my brain convinces itself that I'm going to make a fool of myself and they're going to want to verbally abuse me / beat me up. I'm an over 6 foot male, and the most recent time this anxiety happened was over talking to a teacher over a foot shorter than me. I'm completely aware this is irrational, but that doesn't fix the problem. And I feel that a lot of people, older people than me, assume that pointing at my anxiety is stupid will fix it." Mm. Ben, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you so much for giving us that insight about how it affects you and drawing that parallel between, you know, there's assumptions about how you look and how you'll behave, which aren't necessarily true or correct. Sarah, I'd love you to, if Ben was in front of you right now, what would you say to him?
Gosh, I just think that it's such an irrational fear, our social anxiety. And Ben, what I would say is it's not stupid. Anyone who is experiencing any kind of anxiety, to have that dismissed or to have that invalidated is going to, of course, make you feel very hurt and make it feel as though, you know, this anxiety that is very, very real for you shouldn't be. So when we're talking about how we can overcome that, it's about ensuring that we have that practice. So it's not absolutely not about stupidity. It's not about, you know, dismissing or diminishing ourselves as a person. It's about ensuring that we have and make opportunities, essentially for exposure therapy, that we're getting out there, that we're having difficult conversations, that we're trying. And over time, that is going to be alleviating a lot of your symptoms. So I really hope, Ben, that you're able to go and see a good psychologist so that they can help you through this process.
And I think it's a really interesting phenomenon too, because I can relate to Ben, you know, this idea that we are so, I think, hard on ourselves. You know, when I'm afraid to go into a networking event or a party by myself, it's because it's true. I'm afraid that someone will judge me and think poorly of me, just like Ben thinks someone's going to judge him. But we don't give enough credit to the people around us as well, that actually when someone comes and says hello to me at one of those events, I'm so grateful, I'm so happy. And I think, oh, that's a really nice thing that they did. They could see that I was anxious. They came to connect with me. And the intentions of the other people are not as bad as we think they are in our heads. And I have to tell that to myself constantly also.
And that's so important, right? So we have to be kind and compassionate to ourselves. We have to be reassuring ourselves. And I can almost guarantee you, Bev, that majority of people in those networking events are going to be feeling something similar to you.
100%. 100%. Right? But we forget that in our absolutely. In the haze of our own fear. So I've got a text here from Dawn in Newcastle. She says, yes, we have the problem, but how do we cope or cure it? So Sarah, if you don't mind, how do we work on this? How do we work towards fixing social anxiety in ourselves?
Absolutely. And I've got to just caveat this by saying
general advice?
That this is general yes. advice only. Please make sure that you go see a GP and go and get a referral to see a psychologist. But the general treatment around this is going to be identifying our fears, identifying those sorts of negative judgments and perceptions that we might have about ourselves, and then also going and doing some behavioral exercises, behavioral experiments, where we're going and testing ourselves and seeing how we go in different kinds of anxiety-provoking settings.
What would that look like? Sorry.
So for instance, you know, seeing if we can get through making a phone call, or seeing if we can, you know, go to somewhere that might provoke a little bit of that anxiety, do that first. And then the next step would be go somewhere that it provokes a bit more anxiety, and working up so that we can eventually go and do something that feels super risky and threatening, but we've sort of climbed that exposure therapy ladder in order to get there.
Let's take one final call from Leanne in Sydney. Leanne, you see yourself as a professional and private introvert. Professional extrovert, does that mean, and private introvert?
Yes, go on. Absolutely.
Hi.
This is a great discussion. Yes, I work professionally in cultural institutions, in front of house, in events. I've been involved in community theatre. So people see me as somebody supremely confident, which I can do, but that's my professional face. And privately, I prefer small gatherings. And my best friends know to warn me that they're having a gathering of 100 people and they don't actually expect me to come.
Leanne, are we the same person?
We might be, yes.
That's so interesting, that contrast. I can really relate to it. And it doesn't mean that when you're being the professional extrovert, that that's not part of you. It's just a kind of part of you that you're able to turn on for specific purposes. Does that sound right to you?
It does, yes. I'm quite compartmentalized. So for me, you know, when I'm interacting professionally, it's absolutely me. It's genuine. It's not pretend, it's not fake, but that's the professional side. And I really don't like to have to put the professional face on for social interactions. I find that exhausting.
I think we are the same person, Leanne. Good on you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for the discussion.
Yeah, you're most welcome. Sarah, before we go today, I'm just curious, what is the benefit of going to see if you have an official diagnosis of social anxiety disorder?
The benefit is going to be that we are not just, I guess, finding out that there is a reason, there's a really valid reason for the way that we are feeling, but most importantly, it's about supporting yourself to be able to do the things that you need to do, that you want to do, the kind of life that you aspire to living. And if you feel as though your anxiety is really getting in the way of those sorts of things, then we do need to be finding strategies to overcome those barriers and those hurdles so that you can engage with the people and do the tasks that you would like.
Let's see if we can fit one more caller in, Melanie in New South Wales. Melanie, you are calling in because you really connected with what a previous millennial caller said about texting, but you're 80. Tell me what you're relating to.
Well, I'm about to turn 80.
About to turn 80. Pardon me. Happy early birthday.
No, I really related to Lisa because that's my frustration. So everybody wants to text these days. And nobody wants to answer a phone call, but my preference is to talk to people. So when I'm texting, I think listening to these callers, I think texting possibly has the potential to create some social anxiety. Because for me, I'll get halfway through a text and I'll go, oh, I'm not saying this the way I want to say it. I need to talk to them and, you know, so I'll ring them up.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then I'll get a situation where, and this is the other thing, I ring them and they're too busy to take my call, I'll call you back. So I wait around. You know, I might be too busy when they call me back. What do you reckon?
That's that phone tag frustration, the text tag as well.
Yes. Anyway, it's not to do with I do think texting has the potential to cause some social anxiety or some anxiety. Yeah.
Yes. And
anyway,
appreciate your time. Have a good day. Thanks for your call.
Thank you,
Sara O'Doherty. Thank you for your time as well. Sara is a registered psychologist and the president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Really appreciate all of your input today, Sara.
Thanks so much for having me.
Next up, the aunties are figuring out a problem of bedtime clashes. Let's work it out.
I'll bet you didn't know we're the biggest gambling nation in the world.
Blackjack.
Last spin. Come on.
If you become a poker player, don't blame me.
I'm putting my money where my mouth is to find out why.
We have an industry that is just running riot.
And if we really are the lucky country.
My God, that seems like such a lot of money.
Totally crippled my life.
Bingo.
Join me, Sean McAuliffe, going for broke.
Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
When early starts and late nights begin to clash, it's time to ask Auntie. Welcome to our aunties, Jo Sullivan, journalist and producer. Hi, Jo.
Hello.
Nice to see you. And Amy Middleton, writer and founder of Archer Magazine. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your first time auntie.
Yeah, nice to be here.
We'll be very gentle with you. Jo, coming from the world of breakfast TV and radio, how have you managed having a different sleep schedule from your partner and the rest of your family?
Oh, boy, what a question. Not very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was probably one of the rare people when I was working on breakfast TV and now breakfast radio, where sometimes I would be a heavy napper during the day and effectively have two sleeps of 4 or 5 hours. It's not good for your body.
Yeah. And also really hard for spending time with your family who
100%.
Are not on that schedule.
So, and that's the thing. I was trying to time my sleep so I could be there for the family. But when you're in this constant state of waking up, trying to go to sleep, it got to a point blank, my wife said to me, "You're grumpy all the time."
Yeah.
It's not fun.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Amy, how does lack of sleep affect you?
So badly. Yeah. It's one of my big scourges of my life. Lack of sleep. I am currently quite fatigued because my kid woke me up through the night.
Okay. All right. It's really good to have you both here. This is probably going to hit home for both of you. So let's hear what Timothy, who wrote our letter this week, is going to share with us. So Timothy says, "My partner and I have two young kids, so we usually go to bed at 9-ish and try to get as much sleep as possible between kid wake-ups. It's especially important for me because I start work at 6 a.m. and work about an hour away, which has me setting alarm for 4:30 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Can relate.
Yuck.
Yep. Can relate also. Given how exhausted we both always are, we've never even thought to talk about this arrangement. But this month, my wife was keen to go out for drinks with workmates, and I was excited for her to have a night to let loose." Jo, this situation, the non-existent social lives of parents with young kids, again.
Can relate. Yeah, this is a great scenario to be discussing.
Yeah. And Amy, what's jumping out at you about this scenario? Is any kind of warning sign about this arrangement?
Anytime there has not been a conversation, it's a big red flag for me. But yeah. I can relate to both people in this letter. I fill my cup by going out with friends.
Yeah.
Extrovert. There you go. And so I think it's really important to get your needs met, particularly when you're a parent.
Mm. I reckon you're a bit of an extrovert too, Jo.
extrovert, introvert, I think.
Yeah.
But I think this is interesting because I think sometimes when you're a parent and, you know, young kids involved here, you can sort of fall into a bit of a malaise, I think, of just sort of accepting like this is it for a while. And so when something like this comes up, I can understand it being a bit of a spanner in the works.
Yeah. But also nice that he's excited for his wife.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
as
really
he should
nice.
Be. That's as right. he should be.
As he should be. That's right. Let's hear that loud and clear. Okay. Let's see how Tim's wife's night on the town turns out, shall we? Okay. So Tim says, "I assumed she'd be home around 11 and I'd just watch footy and go to bed once she was back. Although I'd never want to be the kind of partner who limits her in any way, I, of course, still worry about her when she's not home. Plus, I'm a light sleeper and figured if I went to bed at 9 and got woken at 11, I'd have a worse night anyway. But then the night arrived and at 11, I found myself on the couch not having heard from her. I didn't want to text like a jealous husband. So around midnight, I tried to go to sleep. Amy, I think there is quite a bit to unpack in this section. What do you think?
Well, I can actually relate to this experience of Tim, was it?
Yes.
My longest relationship was my 10-year marriage, which happened to be with a touring musician.
Oh, wow.
And she would be at work, but it was late nights. And I'm an anxious guy, and I would be at home slightly worried, also just overthinking the time of arrival. And it really drove me nuts. So I can kind of relate to Tim.
What about the expectation, though, Joe, of she's going out for a night on the town, but she'll be home by 11?
As my kids would say to me when I've said something dumb, bruh.
that doesn't sound very realistic.
It doesn't. That's why I'm giving the bruh vibes. I'm like, mate, come on. Like, I think this goes back to a little bit about what you're saying, Amy, about the conversation needs to be had. If you're setting the expectations and not communicating that, you're not getting back the other way. Like, actually, we're going to be doing X, Y, and Z. We're going to be doing this, that, and the other. And I think that's where this communication really needs to come into play.
As the segment's resident husband, auntie here representing today, speaking for all husbands, what do you think about his characterization of, I don't want to text like a jealous husband, that kind of thing. I don't want to be the partner who limits her in any way. I mean, I also feel like there's a lot of disclaiming happening here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I'm immediately jumping to what I would have like to have done in this situation.
Yeah, that's
myself,
what I want to hear from you.
Which is have that sort of chat. I mean, my wife and I are having this chat ourselves today. She's working in the city. She wants to catch up with friends after work, go out for dinner. Fantastic. Do you need me to come pick you up? What's the scenario? Have a little bit of a chat beforehand. What's it, you know, setting those sort of expectations. Okay, you're going to get an Uber home? Great, fantastic.
Do you set a curfew?
I think that is a very antiquated situation.
Okay.
Particularly, like,
Joe's body language now is deeply uncomfortable at the question.
I'm wondering if Joe sent this letter in.
No, we don't do that here. Amy, I want to ask you if you're Tim right now. I mean, you have said that, but in terms of like checking the clock, being jealous, how is that? I'm very interested in that, the choice of word being a jealous husband.
It sounds a little bit like a projection, doesn't it? I mean, I would never have called myself jealous. It's more about setting expectations and verbalizing them and then finding a compromise that meets everyone's needs.
Having a concern.
You almost can always find a space where everybody's like, okay with the situation,
yeah.
If you have the conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got young kids. I mean, you do have to eventually come home and face the children, right? Okay, let's get to the final part of Timothy's letter. He writes, at 1 a.m., she finally got home and was drunk, so it was a bit noisy getting in, waking the kids and me. I know she's keen to do work drinks again next month. I don't want to be a downer on her fun, but is it reasonable to ask if she come home by midnight and she could try to check in once or twice during the night? Okay, new info here. So 1 a.m., I feel like sympathy for the wife and the way she's being characterized, to be honest.
Yeah, we're only getting one perspective here.
Yeah.
I tend to agree in this sort of situation. There's an element here of like, is this control or is this concern?
Yes.
And this is what I'm having a hard time unpacking here, because he might be feeling genuine concern and he might be aware that that could be seen as controlling. But I think he wants to set the curfew, and I'm a little bit repulsed by that. I know it's a strong word.
You'd be uncomfortable, right?
I'm uncomfortable because at the end of the day, you're a husband and wife.
Yeah.
She's not your teenage daughter.
Yes. Okay. I love that you've said that, Joe. Thank you for that. I think it is really important to name that feeling of discomfort that we're having with the way the letters, the way the wife's behavior is being framed, Amy. So, but if we were to just step back and give it the most generous reading possible, which
that's
is
what I'll do.
Concern, what are your thoughts now in terms of what Tim is wanting to ask of his wife? Is it reasonable to ask if she come home by midnight?
Well, I think his wording literally in the first part of the letter was he wanted her to let loose. A part of letting loose is like having agency over your own behavior. And if she's showing up after a few beers, I mean, sounds like that was the plan anyway. If he is having trouble sleeping, that's an I statement that he maybe needs to communicate, as opposed to you were drunk. It's more, I had trouble sleeping. can we set some parameters? I mean, the other thing that's coming up for me...
Yeah, it's actually two issues that are
it's maybe
getting
more.
Mixed together. Yes, yes.
Yeah. For me, personally, when I need to blow off some steam, I don't want to be parenting the next day. So
yeah.
I would just wonder if maybe they need to find a night where he doesn't have to wake up at 4:30 in the morning so she can actually feel free and liberated, which as a birth mother, that's something I need once
yes.
a month.
And it is also to think about his concern. It's not like it's unreasonable to be like, hey, do you know what time you might be home? Like, that's actually an open question.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that's a fair question to ask. And
just so he knows what to expect, right?
Yeah.
And if it is going to be later, maybe send one text. That's not an unreasonable ask.
Yeah.
What do you think, Joe?
Look, I think having that check-in is handy. And, you know, I'm lucky that in my relationship, that generally happens. So, you know, my wife might be out. She might be having dinner. Hey, we're finished. I'm going to catch the train or catch the Uber. Or can you come pick me up? Great. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Excellent. I just wonder as well whether... It's not expressed in this, but I wonder whether there may be, you know, going back to that point about getting into a malaise, whether there might be just a hint of jealousy about the fact that this is going on.
Mm.
Maybe he hasn't had the opportunity to do it. If he's getting up early, he's certainly not doing that midweek. So is there a chance here for him to maybe get a quid pro quo, similar to sort of what you're
Absolutely,
sort of saying?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and everybody's needs can be a bit different. Maybe she doesn't need the check-in because she's a heavy sleeper. It's okay if he does.
So can I ask you two aunties, because you're so wise, you're so smart, you're so clever, you're so kind, do you mind just doing a bit of a role play?
Okay, sure.
All right.
This is not what I was expecting,
but
I'm
here for it. Let's just cast against type. You are Timothy.
Yes.
Amy. Joe, you are the wife. Go ahead, Tim/Amy. How are you going to have this conversation with your wife who came home drunk at 1 a.m.
Well, I'm good at this stuff.
Yeah, so and you'll be hungover, by the way.
Oh, dear.
I would. Terrible.
Okay, firstly, I'll wait till a couple of days later to make sure that the chat goes well. And I'm going to start with a positive. I am so glad that you got to go see your mates. I hope it was really fulfilling and that you feel really glad you did it, because I loved giving you that gift. Also, work was really tough for me that day. I wonder if we could put some parameters in place so that we both know what to expect from a night out. What do you think?
Thanks for the opportunity. I'll be doing it again.
Then I want to do it.
I'm terrible in that situation. I'm more than likely, well, look, yeah, okay, fair enough. I'll see your point of view and you know, apologize for rocking in and trashing the house and waking the kids up. Yeah, I would have been a bit of mayo put on that. But anyway, I think just it goes back to that conversation. But Timothy also might need to there's other ways you can deal with this.
What about an alternative place of sleep? You know,
well,
spare room sleeping.
I was going to suggest she gets a hotel room with her girlfriends once a month.
He's also got the best thing he can do. He can organise an incentive for the next time. So organise a brunch for the following day.
Aunties, you are brilliant. Hope to have you back again soon. Supervising producer of Radio National Breakfast, Joe Sullivan, Amy Middleton, writer and founder of Archer Magazine. The email to write to Life Matters is lifematters@abc.net.au. And a big thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. They are Jack McDonald, Grace Pashley, Lucy Sweeney, Beck Zajac, and executive producer Lachlan McIntosh. Our audio engineer is Elise Simons, and you can find all Life Matters episodes on ABC Listen. Search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow. You're all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Thank you so much for all of your calls and messages. Take care, and I'll chat with you again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.